and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
That was low energy.
Hello, and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a comedy podcast in which two brothers answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. John Green, how are you doing? I mean, no, John, what is the elephant in the room?
All right, are you ready? 3, 2, 1, manhole.
The Golden State Killer.
So my elephant in the room is manhole. Hank, in last week's pod, you suggested that a really excellent name for a pet would be manhole. I put you under a lot of pressure to come up with 20 good pet names in 20 seconds, and you came up with 7, and I thought you were going to crush it. But then you came up with manhole, which was pretty disappointing, except that several people were inspired to name their own pets manhole, including Abby, who wrote in, Dear John and Hank, I'd like to introduce you to Manhole, or Manny for short, and adorable little kitten. She also signed off, she's not too shh, Abby. Really good name specific sign off, Abby. Mm-hmm. Also, Jack wrote in to introduce us to his fish manhole, and Anna went so far as to rename her 15-year-old cat, who had previously been named Casper, which is a perfectly reasonable cat name, but is now named Manhole, which I'm sure your 15-year-old cat will be very grateful for, Anna. I'm sure that that's going to be a highlight, is being suddenly renamed in the last presumably few years of your life.
Yeah, and like the twilight years of your cat's life is just like, wait, what?
It's always been my hope to retire and be renamed Manhole.
Well, you know, John, you could do that right now. You could just be done, and all you're going to do is podcast with me, and that's it. And
then
I'll just
I wouldn't
be
like,
done. Welcome to Dear Hank and Manhole.
I would not be done, just for the record. My retirement does not involve podcasting with you every week.
Well, then do not retire.
Hank, why is the Golden State Killer the elephant in the room?
I don't listen to many true crime podcasts or consume much true crime content. I don't really like it. It gives me the heebie-jeebies. But I do follow a number of people on Twitter who are super into true crime, including people who are kind of into it professionally and do that for a living. And the Golden State Killer is a guy who killed a bunch of people more than a decade ago. I don't know how many more than a decade.
Oh, like it was like 40 years ago. And as a result of Michelle McNamara's and her colleagues' work, at least in part, the Golden State Killer has been arrested just this morning as we're recording this. He is a 72-year-old man today, but more than 40 years ago, he began attacking women and has been responsible for several murders and many more assaults and has been captured today. It is an incredible story that this 40-year search for a criminal has finally come to an end. So congratulations to everybody who's worked so hard on that, to all the law enforcement people involved on closing that case and that very dark chapter in California history. Hank.
And John, thank you for knowing a lot more about my elephant than I did. It's just trending on Twitter, and that's all I knew.
Oh, yeah. I haven't been on Twitter today. How's it been?
I figured out how to tweet nothing.
Oh, well, that is a huge development.
John, how are things going? Is everything good over the John Green world?
Yes, I'm just back from London, where I spent a few days with my son in London. It was his first international trip since we lived for a few months in Amsterdam when he was one, and we had a great time. We had a really, really lovely time together, and he got to have a really special visit to AFC Wimbledon, which is something that he's been looking forward to for a long time as a member of the Don's Junior Trust, which any child can join. It's only like $25 a year. It's so great to be a co-owner of this wonderful community-owned fan-based club, and Henry had a really wonderful special day. He got to meet a bunch of the players. They signed a ball for him. It was really, really wonderful. But we'll get to all of that during the news from AFC Wimbledon. Hank, we need to get, speaking of true crime, to our first question.
Oh.
This question comes from Herbie, who asks, Dear John and Hank, do dead bodies get sunburn? Not planning anything. Herbie.
Well, thank you for the clarification, Herbie.
Yeah, otherwise we would have thought that you were planning anything. Just kidding, Herbie. That's what people who are planning things say. They say they're not planning anything.
John, you might be surprised to learn that I did a bunch of research on whether dead bodies get sunburned.
I didn't have to do research on it because I was just in the British Museum where I saw a heavily sunburned dead body just sitting there in the middle of the museum. And they were like, Look at this mummy. He dried out in the sun and we know how he died. And I was trying to shield Henry from it. But Henry was like, oh, wow, that is amazing. And
good.
And Henry was like, he died of a shoulder wound. He got stabbed by a long knife. And I was like, great. I'm glad that... glad that we know this much about this 8,000-year-old man, and I'm sure that he would be absolutely delighted to find himself dried and sunburnt in the British Museum. Can dead bodies get sunburned, Hank?
They can get damaged by the sun, but a sunburn is a pretty specific set of things that happen, and it is not just the damage that is done. In fact, like basically what happens is your cells get damaged by the sun, and then your body has a reaction and inflames that area to do the repair work. And a lot of times that is actually the thing that is causing the discomfort, is the inflammation of the repair rather than the damage itself. But the damage itself also can cause a lot of problems, and depending on how severe it is. So yeah, it's the cells can get damaged, and they can get damaged whether or not they are alive. And actually, like, interestingly, cells continue to like do some metabolizing stuff after the what we would consider the death. So they can, the individual cells will continue to be alive even after the person is dead. And so you could still get some of that inflammation. You could get some of that, even some like melanin production. So you would get a very, maybe even tiny amount of tanning that would happen after the body died, but only for a very short amount of time.
Well, I am glad that I know that. I feel that my life has been enriched almost as much as if I had learned how to tweet nothing.
I got to keep working on how to on tweeting nothing, John.
I mean, wouldn't it be amazing if we all just started tweeting nothing?
Wouldn't it be? It's just like suddenly my timeline was just like for an entire day, nothing. Just people then, tweeting, but there was nothing in the tweets.
Maybe we could expand
maybe that
it
should
to
be a
week.
Holiday. We should make that happen. Uh-huh. Are we powerful enough to create a day on which people just tweet nothing? How powerful are we? Are we there yet? Because that's really the goal.
First off, we're on the other side of the mountain. So when you say, are we there yet? It implies that we're about to become more famous, when in fact we will just become slowly less and less powerful over the next several decades, which I would argue is welcome news. The people who have replaced us are far better on every level. Secondly, no, we are not even close to powerful enough to have a site-wide day of tweeting nothing. No.
And then just everybody responds to each other with nothing, and then like there's more nothing, and everybody likes each other's tweets and retweets nothing. I don't know, John. See, the thing we're not getting more popular. Fewer people are knowing who we are. Agreed. But what if we're getting more influential because the people who do know who we are getting really good jobs in like managing social media celebrity accounts? Just let us know.
You think the person who's tweeting for Kanye right now is a Nerdfighter?
Yeah, who knows?
I mean, whoever's tweeting for Kanye, just a quick word of advice. Stop.
Tweet nothing.
Tweet nothing. And maybe, in fact, that's good advice for all of us. I find myself less and less interested in Twitter. My interest in Twitter is limited almost exclusively to your podcast, Delete This.
Well, it is probably the best way to consume Twitter. It only takes an hour of your life every week, and you don't have to be on Twitter.
Yeah, it's been great so far. I've really enjoyed it. Hank, why don't you ask another question?
This question comes from Sarah, who asks, Dear Hank and John, I've heard that newborns think that their mother's body is just part of their own body. How do we know what babies think? How do you science a baby? Que sera, Sarah?
I don't know that we know that much about what babies think, Sarah, but we know that even like four-year-olds still sort of think of their mothers as an extension of their bodies.
Here's a really weird thing, John. I realized, a few months into my child being born, and when he was a suddenly new person in the world, it was like, yes, this was created entirely by Catherine. This was a construction completely of things that Catherine did, which is remarkable. But then he's gotten doubled in size. He's starting to do things and smile and interact. And still, though, he's still entirely Catherine, because at that point he'd only ever had breast milk in his whole life. Right. This baby is an entire, so in a way, yes, do they think that they're part of their mother's body? I'm taking that question and I'm discarding it for a second to say they are. Like, physically, everything that was him up to 8 months old, maybe not that long, I don't know when he had his first banana, licked his first piece of bacon or whatever, but for a long time, there was this human that was entirely constructed out of things Catherine had eaten.
Right. It is weird. No, the more you think about babies, the weirder they get. The more you think about human life in general, the weirder it gets.
Or just life in general. The thing about babies is, it's the most natural thing. Of course, there is no biology. There are no humans without babies. That's the whole point, is to reproduce. That's how biology works.
Well, it's not the whole point.
Sorry, I don't mean to say that in terms of it's the whole point of life. It's certainly not the whole point of life. But it is in terms of evolution, in terms of how the sort of physical constraints of biology, it does not function without reproduction. But it seems like the weirdest thing, despite it being literally the only necessary part of life.
Right. If you were trying to explain reproduction to an alien planet that didn't have life the way that we have it, they would be like, what? Why? How? Why do the babies come out of the parents? Why do they have to eat part of the parents' body to survive? That's terrible. It's like there's a great, very short science fiction story that I'm going to butcher in the way of these things that talks about trying to introduce humans to an alien bureaucracy, explaining what kind of organism they are. And the bureaucrat is explaining to their boss that humans are a sentient species that is entirely made out of meat.
Yeah, I've heard this story.
And the boss is like, what? Even their thinking parts?
Yeah, meat. They're all meat.
No, we're just a bunch of collections of meat, really, deep down. That's all we are. So, yes.
Yeah, there's a YouTube video of it, which is what I've seen. It's called They're Made Out of Meat. And they're sitting in a diner, a roadside diner. And the guy's like, what? They're made of meat.
Yeah. So there you go. It's not just that babies think of their mothers as an extension of their body. In a way, we're all extensions of each other's bodies. And we're all
made. That is actually where I intended to go from the beginning with this question.
Out of
meat.
We
think that we're separate organisms, but we are not.
No, it's the more you think about it, the grosser and weirder it gets. Let's move on to another question.
Are you too upset, John?
I really like the idea, as you know, Hank, of being a sovereign being separate from other beings that has its own independent existence and life. And I just can't be that because I am super saturated with bacteria and then also made out of meat that is made out of other people. Anyway, this next question comes from Alice, who writes, Dear John and Hank, I was just listening to your most recent episode and really enjoyed the discussion about dates of book releases and how John was denied the ability to choose his own release date because all books come out on Tuesday. So I wanted to let you in on a not-so-secret secret. James Patterson is the only author whose books come out on a day other than Tuesday. All of his books come out on Monday instead. I'm a cataloging librarian who processes all of the new books that our library purchases, so I see many new release books, DVDs, etc. They all come out on Tuesday. except for James Patterson.
Just James Patterson.
So all John has to do is become James Patterson, and then he can choose whichever day of the week he wants to publish his books on, like Wonderland, Alice.
Is it possible
that
James Patterson, all-powerful force in the world, could make all of Twitter tweet nothing for a day? Because clearly, he has some power that we do not have.
Can I tell you a joke that my Uncle Bill, I guess also your Uncle Bill, told me that I just found absolutely hilarious?
Yeah, you should have just said my Uncle Bill so we could continue the conspiracy theory that we're not actually related.
Right, so your Uncle Bill told me this joke. I found it very enjoyable. The joke goes like this. John Grisham calls up James Patterson one afternoon, and James Patterson's wife answers, and John Grisham says, "Is James there?" And Patterson's wife says, "Oh, he is, but I'm afraid he's working on a book. Would it be okay if he called you back?" And John Grisham says, "I'll hold." Because it only takes James Patterson like 10 minutes to write a book.
He must be. He's probably, on average halfway through, so it'll be 5 minutes, right?
Right. So James Patterson gets to publish his books on Monday because he's James Patterson, and like two-thirds of the overall sales
books
of books
that come out. Not sales, just the total books that hit the shelves are James Patterson books.
At any given moment, half of Barnes & Noble is James Patterson and the other half is the rest of us. So yeah. I just wanted to let you know about that, Hank, in case you want to change the release date of your forthcoming novel, An Absolutely Remarkable Thing, which is currently scheduled to come out on a Tuesday, but maybe you need to call them and ask for the Patterson treatment.
Well, it is. Monday is the day to do it, because when I was thinking about this, when I was re-listening to our podcast, which I don't usually do, but I did with the last podcast, it was really good. I enjoyed it. We did a good job. And I'm thinking about this, that like, okay, you can't come out on Wednesday because they're going to open the box early, but you could come out on Monday because they'll open the box. And if they forget, then, well, it's a day late. And everybody's in there being like, you need to open the James Patterson box. And and you're getting, it's more good publicity for you because people are tweeting about it.
Well, there you go, Hank.
You certainly can't come out on Wednesday. That's just ludicrous.
You've just had the revelation that James Patterson had 25 years ago, and that is the sole reason that he has become the most successful author in the United States.
There must be like a bulwark against the second author being added to the Monday list, because it would ruin everything. And suddenly it'd be like, well, I'm a Tuesday author, so I'm not a big deal. But like, if it's just James Patterson, you know that like, well, I'm not James Patterson. But if it's like five people, you're like, well, why am I not one of those five people, publisher? And then you're writing it into your contract and you're feeling hurt when your book comes out on Tuesday. You're not a real author. You're a Tuesday author.
All of this reminds me of how much publishing and so much of life in adulthood is identical to middle school.
Yeah, I'm a Tuesday author, John, and I'm happy. Just like I was happy to be a complete social outcast in middle school. That's a lie. It was miserable.
Oh, it was terrible. I mean, I felt terrible for you, but I felt worse for myself when it was happening to me.
All right, John, this question is very peripheral related. It's from Emily, who asks, Dear Hank and John, due to the upcoming release of Avengers Infinity War and the press tour that's happening, I've started to ask myself about fame. What exactly is the reason I want to watch every interview with Benadryl Cucumber Patch? I did not notice that the first time I read through the question, so it was a bit of a surprise. Benadryl Cucumber Patch. I understand that my personal reaction to fame is very subjective and based on my interests. If I met a famous soccer player, I'd be like, wow, that's a famous person. But I wouldn't freak out. Why do we respond to the construct of quote-unquote fame like this, and when did it start? Who were the first fans? That's a fascinating question. Looking forward to learning more in Hank's novel, An Absolutely Remarkable Thing. It's available September 25th, and you can get it for pre-order now, signed on Books A Million, Barnes & Noble, and Amazon.com. DFTBA, Emily.
Also, signed copies will be available at your local independent bookstore, Emily. But to get to your question, I think fame is really weird, and I think the way that we worship it is really weird, and I am saying this genuinely. I have never read as convincing or compelling a portrayal of fame and the ways that it can be both addictive and corrosive as Hank's novel. It is so smart in the way it writes about that stuff, in the way that it looks at it through the lens of this young woman who becomes initially somewhat famous and then wildly famous as a result of her discovering these Carls, or I guess just one of the Carls. But the thing that gets me about Hank's book that I keep coming back to, and I mean, I first read it like 6 months ago, and the reason I can't stop thinking about it is because this young woman can't stop making compromises with herself to continue to become more famous, even though she recognizes pretty early on that she doesn't actually want to become more famous. And that really resonates with me, not only because of my personal experience, but also because of the people I've had around me who were far more famous than I was, and uh-huh. seeing the difficulties that they went through. I just think it's a brilliant book. I really do. I'm really excited for people to read it because of that.
That was very kind, John. We'll just take that and put that whole thing on the back cover of the book, and everybody will be very happy. Available September 25th. I've been thinking a lot about specifically... So there's this sort of out-of-vogue idea in psychiatry and psychology that... There are these fundamental fears, and there's only three of them, and I can't remember all three of them at the moment. But one of them is the fear of being negatively judged. And I think that we are all like very driven by other people's opinions of us. And it's very hard once you start to have like a lot of people having opinions about you. It's almost that the quantity of opinions is superior to the quality of whatever opinion is happening to be had. So a lot of people would almost rather have people think things about them at all than to have people think positive things about them. And that's not, I think, actually that irrational of a response, because we, like, our society values, influence. Like, our society values power. And I think that just like our brains value power, because ultimately you want to be in a place where you can say, okay, September 25th is no tweet day.
I don't want to be in that place. I have to say, I don't buy that, because I genuinely don't want to have that power.
Right.
And I don't think that power should be vested in one person. I think that power should be vested in institutions. And I think the worship of individuals and individual power is a big part of the problem that we find ourselves in.
But I think that it's the simple way to imagine things. And so when you don't have a lot of direct experience with it, which most people don't, I think that it is very common for people to sort of feel like, oh, that's very appealing, that's very exciting, and imagine what it would be like to be Kim Kardashian. And I think that that sort of bears out in the popularity of Kim Kardashian. Like, people are excited about her because of her influence, and sort of like imagining that in a sort of hashtag goals kind of way.
The thing is that I don't think Kim Kardashian actually has that much power, right? There's this Run the Jewels lyric that goes, like, who really runs this? Like, who really runs that man that says he runs this? And to me, that's the truth, that mm-hmm. beneath the individuals who feel that they are wielding power, or who we feel are wielding power, is a much larger power system that we don't look at very carefully, because mm-hmm. we're so concerned with the individuals rather than with the system that produces them and pushes them in this or that direction.
Yeah, like, literally no one is powerful enough to create no tweet day. No one can do that. And like that in itself, it sort of says something very interesting about how we imagine power and how we imagine power acting upon us. That, like, in some ways, there is a force, but that force is not controlled by any individual, and any, like, even close to any individual. And so all societal changes have to happen slowly, because there is no one who is making these decisions consciously. But to Emily's question, I am curious, who were the first fans, John? Who were the first, like, was it like Euclidides?
Who's Euclidides?
I made it up. I was trying to come up with like a playwright.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I mean, early playwrights had fans. I think that for we don't know, because I think that way we have of giving power and influence to individuals, even though in many ways those individuals are only expressing the whims of much larger forces that are bigger than any of us. I think that goes all the way back. I think that goes back to the earliest human communities. It's just that those early human communities were, you know, a few dozen or a few hundred people big. And so it wasn't as widespread. There wasn't global fame until, you know, I don't know, the 18th or 19th century.
We got another question, John, that I really think we need to focus on here. It's from Mara, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, my boyfriend's mom and stepdad recently bought a home and have subsequently acquired 500 bottles of the previous owner's homemade wine.
Oh,
apparently,
God.
They tried a bottle, and the wine wasn't very... I'm just going to stop reading this question right now. You got to throw that wine away. You might die. You might kill somebody if you sell it on Craigslist. You got 499 bottles of poison."
Yeah, first off, how bold a person do you have to be to open up someone else's homemade wine? Like, do you know what happened to that person? Do you know how you came to own this property? Is it possible that you came to own this property because they died of homemade wine poisoning?
Yeah, or they had to flee the country because their homemade wine killed someone, or they killed someone and put them in the homemade wine.
There are so many terrifying possibilities. Get rid of that homemade wine. Hank, I don't know if you know this, but I made homemade wine once.
Oh, I bet. I bet you did.
When Sarah and I lived in New York, we spent an exorbitant amount of money on a homemade wine kit, and I'm not sure what I thought was going to happen, because I should have known.
This is such a beautiful picture, you and Sarah in like your tiny apartment in New York, just being like, we're going to be vintners.
That's totally what we were thinking. 600 square feet and ready for commercial wine production. And, you know, I made like 1 5-gallon jug of wine, and it was so incredibly bad. And I just remember thinking to myself, I spent $400 on this one incredibly bad 5-gallon bucket of wine. I will never ever engage in any kind of
and how was it
gardening or horticulture ever again. It was so bad. I mean, it tasted enough like grape juice, because it was, the alcohol content was way lower than it should have been. It tasted enough like grape juice that I did eventually work my way through the entire 5 gallons, but only because I knew that it had cost me $400 frickin' dollars.
Well, so, you know, 5 gallons of wine is a lot. My experience with homemade wine is that people bring it over to your house, and then you say to yourself, I wish I was drinking real wine.
Even $3 wine. Now, of course, I don't want to hurt the feelings of all the hardcore homemade wine people out there. I'm sure that your homemade wine is great, but do not bring it to my house.
Yeah, I don't trust you. Let's be honest. I don't trust you to create something that I enjoy the flavor of, and I don't trust you not to kill me. John, I have an important update. I said vintner when I was talking about someone who makes wine.
Yeah.
It is, in fact, vintner, and I would like you to know when I typed in vintner into the Google, the first thing that came up, it says, noun, vintner, the coldest of the four seasons.
No way.
It does. I think it's a different language, maybe.
No way.
That's what it says. Vintner, the coldest of the four seasons on Wiktionary.
You know, Vintner. It does. It does. It's Danish. Hank,
you've
been a Danish speaker this whole time. It's the Danish, Norwegian, and Swedish word for winter. So there you go. All right, Hank, let's get to this question from Carly, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, my friends Snapchat and drive. They snap themselves talking into the camera, singing to the radio, or they just snap a video of the dashboard because they like the song on the radio. Obviously, this is dangerous, but I haven't managed to convince anyone that they're doing anything wrong. Driving feels safe, even though it is the most dangerous thing people do every day. How do I get through to my friends before they kill us all? Wonderwall and Rex, Carly." Carly, there need to be more people in the world like you who are afraid of the things that we should be afraid of and not afraid of the things that we shouldn't be afraid of, like shark attacks or whatever. I have vlogged while driving. I feel terrible about it. I feel like I made a terrible, terrible example that other people might have followed and thereby endangered their lives. It's not a funny business. It is so incredibly serious. One of the very few ways in which life is getting worse for humans in 2018 is that the number of motor vehicle accidents leading to serious injury and death in the United States is not dropping, even though our cars are getting safer. And the reason it's not dropping is because of distracted driving.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if there's a way to sort of like do it in a way that isn't super confrontational and doesn't drive people to defensiveness, where they sort of like get even more tied into their bad way of behaving. If there's some kind of like basically meme that you can create among your friends that like you are the person who cares about this and you're going to give them a hard time about it every single time, and that's because you love them. If there's like, you're just going to, you basically draw like a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Yep.
And he's called Snappy the Don't Snap While You're Driving T-Rex.
Yep.
And you take a picture and send that to them every time, and you say, every time you get a Snappy, I'm not talking to you for a day. There's no more Snapchatting. And I'm assuming by the fact that you're using Snapchat that you are under the age of 25. And so everyone you're Snapchatting with is fairly new to the whole driving thing. And that is when a lot of accidents happen. When people are fairly new to the driving thing, you start to think that you're pretty good at it, but it turns out that you haven't experienced a lot of the things that you might experience, the sort of outside edge cases of traffic unfortunateness. And then people end up hurt, and it's very bad, and like a legitimate cause of a tremendous amount of tragedy and pain in the world. And so I think that like if you can put together a good old Snappy the T-Rex, don't snap while you're driving T-Rex picture, please do that. Do I have the power to do that at least, John?
Probably, although I think that your understanding of both teen culture and meme culture are pretty weak. But I like the idea of Snappy the T-Rex. It doesn't seem at all like a cringy thing invented by a 38-year-old. To keep the young people from distracted driving. It doesn't seem like that at all. It seems like people are totally going to respond to that. They're going to be like, oh, wow, I got a Snappy the T-Rex. I'm in big trouble.
John, this is how it happens. This is how terrible ideas occur. But I swear, if an actual teen does this, and it's their idea, not mine, it will be super cool, right?
Yes, it will be super cool. Carly, I actually think that's a pretty good idea, which speaks to the fact that I'm even older than Hank. And I guess there is an off chance that you are yourself our age, Carly, in which case your friends have two problems. One, they shouldn't be Snapchatting. That is for young people. And two, they shouldn't be driving while distracted. But anyway, all of that reminds me, Hank, that today's podcast is brought to you by our number one most important sponsor, Snappy the T-Rex. Snappy the T-Rex reminding you not to snap while driving. Is snap the right verb for Snapchatting? I don't even know.
Yes.
Not to snap while driving since 2018.
And this podcast is also brought to you by James Patterson's Tweet Nothing Day. James Patterson's working together with social media celebrities across the world, including the nerdfighter who runs Kanye West's Twitter account, to create a day in which no one tweets anything, but you do tweet something, it's just nothing's in the tweets.
And, of course, today's podcast is brought to you by 499 bottles of probably poisonous homemade wine. Not for sale.
And finally, this podcast is made out of newborn babies. They're made out of mom.
All right. You didn't say sponsored by. You said that this podcast was made out of newborn babies, but whatever. I like it. I think it's weird. You're pretty sleep deprived because you have a young child, so it's kind of true, and I like it. We also have a Project for Awesome message. Alex donated to the Project for Awesome so that we would read this message to Tommy. You are an amazing person, and your friends and family know it. They all love you. I love you. Never forget that. There is a small chance that I mispronounced Tommy, in which case some of the like movingness of that message would get lost. So in case it's, I'm just going to hope that it's Tommy.
Good job, John. Also, John, we are putting together a Dear Hank and John survey. There's a link to it in the show notes. If you like Dear Hank and John, we want to learn a little bit more about you and also what you'd like us to do on the podcast and the other things that you might be into. So if you could go to the show notes And I don't really know how show notes work, but whatever app you're using, there's probably a thing there, and there will be a link there, and you can use that. It's surveymonkey.com/r/DHJSurvey2018.
Super easy to remember URL. This is not like one of those annoying surveys that other podcasts make you take where they only ask questions about how to market more effectively to you. This is a survey where we ask questions about how to market more effectively to you and also other things.
Yeah.
So accurate. Please take the survey if you have a chance. It is really, really helpful for us to understand who you are and what mm-hmm. stuff you're into, what you like about the pod, what you don't like, what you'd like to see more of and less of, that sort of thing.
Okay, John, this next question comes from Mark, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, so what do you do when you're mad crushing on somebody who lives a long way away? Is it better to be honest, stay as friendly correspondents, or just wean... Is it better to be honest, stay as friendly correspondents, or just wean off communication to save yourself some heartache? P&P, Mark." What's P&P, Pride and Prejudice?
I assume so, but it could also be Procter & Procter, a new and exciting new multinational corporation. It could refer to one of the world's largest golf cart dealerships, P&P Golf Carts. It could refer to P&P Home Services. Oh, wait, Urban Dictionary, P&P means party and play, which is about sex, stuff, and meth. Why did you trick us, Mark? The rest of your question was pretty normal, and then you made us say a meth thing. God, as if we weren't already old enough, Hank, after inventing Snappy the anti-distracted driving T-Rex. Good Lord.
Okay. I mean, I think that in general, when the love compounds start flowing in our brains and we start to feel really attached and just it's a lovely feeling, but I think that our brains can start doing a lot of tricks to make us think that a thing is possible when it may not be possible. I feel bad about saying this, but it starts doing all kinds of weird gymnastics, and like your brain turns into like spinny, flippy Simone Biles trying to convince you how you're going to make this work.
I disagree with everything that you just said, except for the fact that Simone Biles is really good at flipping, which she is fantastic at. She's an amazing, amazing athlete. But the rest
flipper.
Of that, what you said, I completely disagree with.
Okay.
It is totally possible to have a fulfilling long-distance relationship. And if that relationship
but
doesn't
this person
end
doesn't
in,
have a relationship yet. This person, he's just crushing on somebody who's a long way away.
Right. So I'm saying if you want to tell the person that you want to be in a long-distance relationship with them, tell them that and see how it goes. And if it doesn't work out, then so whatever. Such is life. But if it does work out, that's great. I know that I'm a big defender of long-distance relationships because I had a really fulfilling one when I was in college. But I don't think there's anything wrong with them. So that's my advice, Mark. Just communicate. That's really
communicate is good.
99% of these questions could be answered with the word communicate followed by an exclamation point.
That's a good shirt. We should make that shirt.
The other 1% of questions can be answered, of course, with Snappy the T-Rex. This next question comes from Fraz, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I'm currently sitting in the middle seat of an airplane using my 15 minutes of free plane Wi-Fi to ask you an incredibly pressing question. Shortly after takeoff, the people on either side of me fell asleep, wasting both the view and the clear access to the bathroom for the foreseeable future. The attendants have just started serving the food, and my question is, can I take the subpar food that was meant for them? Thanks, Fraz."
No, don't take strangers' food from them. They could wake up at any moment.
No, oh, we're going to have to disagree again, I see.
Are you, you're going to steal a stranger's food?
Well,
John,
I'll tell you.
You didn't even buy their house and inherit it.
I'll tell you a story. About 5 days ago, I was flying on a plane with my son to London, and they wake you up, even though I didn't really sleep that well. Because, you know, I was on a plane with my son. They wake you up and they give you breakfast, right? But Henry didn't want to wake up, which credit to him, he was trying to get a full night's sleep on the 6-hour red-eye flight. And so it was like this, I don't even know how you say this, right? Is it like acai? 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 You know those things?
Oh, the little berries? Yeah, I don't know
those,
how
like
to say
berry
it
bowls. It was one of those one of those bowls, and I ate it. It didn't even he wasn't awake. He doesn't care.
He's your son. This is a person you have a relationship with. You steal his food all the time. I steal his food.
Yeah, I guess it's a little bit different.
We know each other.
It's a little bit different, but I don't think it's that different. If the food's just sitting there, just eat it real quick. You're in the middle seat. You're suffering. You're going through a hard time.
You're suffering. Yeah, well, it depends. Like if it's like a Biscoff cracker or like a bag of pretzels, maybe. But if it's like a tray with dinner on it, you can't start picking off their tray.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Bag of pretzels.
And I feel like an acai or a kai or whatever that is, one of those bowls, that's sort of an in-between place. Where you can take the whole bowl and it's like, oh, they just gave me two. They didn't give you one. I got three of them and you two didn't get any. I don't know what happened.
That's what I actually did. I stacked the bowls so that he'd never notice. Till he listens to the pod, that is. All right, Hank, we need to get to the all-important news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon. What is the news from Mars this week?
You know how Mars has two real good moons?
Yes, top-notch moons.
You know, Phobos and Deimos are Mars's two good old moons. They're smaller than our moon. They're sort of lumpy and potato-y because they're not big enough to form themselves into spheres when they were forming.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of sort of question about how they formed. And some people think that they were just captured asteroids because they look like asteroids. They're the size of some asteroids and the shape of asteroids. But and we to be clear, we will know this for sure in like 2029. But I think the Japanese Space Agency is sending a mission to one of those two moons. I couldn't tell you which one. Taking a sample and sending it back. It's a lot easier to send back a sample from Phobos or Deimos because they're so light that the return trip is actually pretty easy because you don't have to escape a gravity well, really. And, so they're going to, like, we'll be able to analyze a piece of one of these moons, which will tell us basically everything we ever wanted to know. So, but at the moment, it remains a mystery. But they probably aren't captured asteroids, which was our theory for a long time, because they both are in, they rotate around Mars right at Mars's equator, which would be a really weird coincidence if they were captured asteroids. They also rotate in a way that would be very strange for them to be in such like non-elliptical orbits. Their orbits are pretty circular. If they were captured asteroids. And also, there have been some computer models that say, like, if you capture these moons that way, they would be ripped apart by the tidal forces of being captured in Mars's gravity. So the new theory was that, like, Mars was hit, just like Earth was, in early in the solar system's formation by a giant impactor of some kind, and that threw off some stuff around Mars that eventually coalesced into these moons. And that impactor was pretty big in our former models, but a new paper just came out and it says that that impactor probably didn't have to be nearly as big as we thought it had to be in order for it to throw up the amount of stuff that ended up in Phobos and Deimos. So there's a new study basically says, yes, it's likely and very probable that it was that these moons were caused by an object, not even that big of an object, certainly big in like global scale catastrophe, but not like the object that hit us that formed our moon and was like less than 1% of the mass of Mars that was able to create these moons. But we won't know that for sure until hopefully the late 2020s, early 2030s, when we start to analyze some actual pieces of these Martian moons.
Whenever I think about the fact that our moon and potentially these two moons as well were formed by asteroids that led to a huge chunk of the planet entering the orbit of the planet.
Yeah.
I am reminded of how stupidly unlikely life as we know it is.
Well, that may be true. It may not be. I don't know. Obviously, we've only got a sample size of one right now in terms of planets that have life on them. But I think there's a lot to be said for the possibility that life could be not as rare as we think. But,
well, it's not that I think
it was very early in the solar system that this happened. And basically, Earth was hit by basically a planet. Like another planet hit us.
Right.
And that's, like, it'd be, I mean, like, what if, like, the thing I think about is, like, all the different ways the dice could have rolled, and we could have ended up with very easily two planets very close to each other, both with a lot of water, both with a lot of, like, good gases that would be conducive to life, and we could have ended up in a solar system where life happened twice in a very big way, the way that it happened on Earth. And that would have been a very different trajectory. When we were, like, early when we first were trying to figure out Mars and we were getting telescopes that could see it pretty well, we were starting to think, like, there's probably life on that planet. But it turned out, when we went, there was not. But what if we had gone and there was? Right. That would have been so deeply different a future for humanity.
It would have been, but in a way, we experienced that in the Columbian Exchange, because there were two worlds that had very mm-hmm. that had a few connecting points, obviously, over the course of the last 250,000 years, but that were pretty separate for a lot mm-hmm. of human history. And then we discovered that there was essentially, you know, a second half of the world, whether yeah. that second half was, you know, Afro-Eurasia or the Americas, depending on your depended, mm-hmm. of course, on where you were when it happened. But yeah, I mean, I think it would be very weird if there were a second planet full of life. And to be clear, I don't think that life is likely to be rare in the universe. I just think the universe is so big.
Yeah.
Yep. It's so weird and big. The more
so weird.
It's so weird and big, and we're made out of meat. But 11 of these meat sticks that we call humans took the field for AFC Wimbledon on Saturday. How's that for a transition?
Did you just say meat sticks?
Yeah, that's basically what we are. Just sort of stick-shaped.
I was
piles
pretty
of
sure
meat.
I knew what your phrase of the week was, but now I'm feeling like meat sticks. We'll see. Now you've made it more complicated for me.
So Henry and I went to see the AFC Wimbledon game against Oldham. We had a really wonderful time. It was a really special day for both of us, and he had such a great time. And I can't recommend going and seeing a Wimbledon game highly enough to people who are even a little bit interested in it. But this was a very important game, because we are now down to the last few games of the season, and it is tight. Tight at the bottom. In the end, it was a 2-2 draw for Wimbledon. Two good goals, one scored by John Meads, one in which John Meads assisted Joe Piggott, who put the ball away very nicely in the back of the net. But unfortunately, Wimbledon gave up two goals, gave up a lead twice. The second goal was scored in the 73rd minute. It was pretty frustrating, but a point is a point, and right now, a point is not a bad result. 3 points would be better. As I've said repeatedly on this podcast, every year for the last 20 years, 52 points has been enough to stay up in League One. We have 50 points with 3 games remaining, so we should only need, by historical standards, 2 points to stay up from the next 3 games. However, it's looking like this season might be the season where you need more than 52 points for the first time in 2 decades, in which case we would need probably to win one of our last 3 games and potentially win one and draw one. It's just so tight at the bottom right now. One mm-hmm. development over the last 7 days is that the franchise currently plying its trade in Milton Keynes has functionally been relegated from League One and will spend next season in the fourth tier of English football.
Wow.
And
happened.
It happened. So now it's just a matter of Wimbledon finding a way to stay up, and maybe we'll never have to play those guys ever again. That would be a good outcome. But yeah, we've got to win one of our last 3 games. The last game of the season is against Barry, who are already relegated. And mm-hmm. so that should be a winnable game, but you never want it to come down to the last game, because all kinds of weird things can happen when people are under unspeakable pressure. I mean, it's stressful, Hank. I wake up, and every morning the first thing I do is look at the League One table and try to figure out all the ways that things could go. But at this point, we just need to play out the last couple games.
Well, I mean, the good thing was I was paying attention to this, that, like, nobody in the bottom of the table won their game.
Yeah.
And
So
that helps.
It does help.
And that you drew is good.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, it's possible that 50 points, the number of points we have now, will be enough, although I suspect not. I suspect we need... Let's just get a win this weekend against Doncaster and just calm down. I mean, this has been the most stressful 43-game stretch that I've had as a sponsor and supporter of AFC Wimbledon. So I am... let's just get those 3 points.
Let's get the points. All right, John. What is my phrase of the week?
Is it bag of pretzels?
Nope, it was not bag of pretzels.
What was it?
Simone Biles.
Oh, God. Of course.
It's a little bit of an unusual phrase of the week suggested by Kimberly from the Project for Austin. Thank you, Kimberly, for Simone Biles.
Wow, that's a great phrase of the week suggestion, Kimberly. Congratulations.
I worked it out. I made it happen. John, I think yours was a sigh bowl.
You're right. That's what it was.
Yes!
Oh, man. I made up that whole story about stealing my son's food. I didn't know how else to work it in. That was suggested by an anonymous Project for Awesome donor. So thank you, Anonymous, for donating to the Project for Awesome. And I mean, let's face it, I'm always bad at the phrase of the week, but especially when it's a word I don't know how to pronounce.
I also had meat sticks and shark attacks as my alts.
Yeah, I mean, meat sticks, I was trying to throw that in there at the last second as a curveball, but you recognized it for exactly what it was.
All right, John, what did we learn today?
Well, we learned that if you come into 499 bottles of homemade wine, you need to dispose of them immediately.
You learned that Snappy the T-Rex can protect you from the actual proper danger that you face daily.
And we learned that James Patterson gets to publish on Mondays.
And we're all made out of meat.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Thanks to Hank for podding with me. And thanks to everybody who supports our podcast on Patreon at patreon.com/DearHankandJohn. We really appreciate it. We use that money to fund Crash Course and SciShow and the art assignment and the other stuff we do here at Complexly. So thank you. And we're going to go record now our podcast for Patreon supporters this week in Ryan's The Worst 8 Minutes of Your Week.
We should talk it up more, John. Catherine listens to it and she says it's good.
Well, I like to lower people's expectations instead of raising them. Hank,
that's probably the right call.
Will you read the credits?
Yeah, if you want to email us your questions, please do that. That's how we make the podcast happen. It's hankandjohn@gmail.com. No dear. And John and I are John Green and Hank Green on Twitter, but less and less so. this podcast is edited by Nicholas Jenkins. It's produced by Rosianna Hals Rojas and Sheridan Gibson. Our head of community and communications is Victoria Bongiorno. The music that you're hearing now and at the beginning of the episode and during This Week in Ryan's is by the great Gunnarola, and as they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.